Unfortunately, my relationship with Bill Bennett didn't fare well after I became president, and he began promoting virtue for a living. Although he had once inscribed a book to me with the words, "To Bill Clinton, the Democrat who makes sense," he apparently came to believe that either he had been wrong or I had lost whatever sense I had when he wrote those words. Around the time of the Meet the Press interview, Senator Joe Biden, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, asked me to testify against Judge Robert Bork, who had been nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court by President Reagan. I knew Joe wanted me because I was a white Southern governor. The fact that I had been Bork's student in constitutional law was an added bonus. Before I agreed, I read most of Bork's articles, important judicial opinions, and published reports of his speeches. I concluded that Judge Bork should not go on the Supreme Court. In an 8-page statement, I said I liked and respected Bork as a teacher and thought President Reagan should have considerable latitude in his appointments, but I still believe the nomination should be rejected by the Senate. I argued that Bork's own words demonstrated that he was a reactionary, not a mainstream conservative. He had criticized almost every major Supreme Court decision expanding civil rights except Brown versus the Board of Education. In fact, Bork had been one of two lawyers, along with William Rehnquist, to advise Barry Goldwater to vote against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. As a Southerner, I knew how important it was not to reopen the wounds of race by disturbing those decisions. Bork had the most restrictive view on what the Supreme Court can do to protect individual rights of anyone who had been nominated to the Supreme Court in decades. He thought dozens of court decisions needed to be reversed. For example, he said a married couple's right to use contraceptives was no more deserving of privacy protection from government action than a utility's right to pollute the air. In fact, as his ruling against Arkansas in the Grand Gulf case showed, he thought utilities and other business interests were entitled to more protection than individual citizens from government actions he disagreed with. However, when it came to protecting business interests, he threw judicial restraint out the window in favor of activism. He even said federal courts shouldn't enforce antitrust laws because they were based on a flawed economic theory. I asked the Senate not to take the risk that Judge Bork would act on his long-held convictions rather than on the more moderate assurances he was then giving in the confirmation process. I had to file the testimony rather than give it in person because the hearings were delayed and I had to leave for a trade mission to Europe. In late October, the Senate rejected the Bork nomination 58-42. I doubt that my testimony influenced a single vote. President Reagan then nominated Judge Antonin Scalia, who was as conservative as Bork but hadn't said and written as much to prove it. He sailed through. In December 2000, in the case of Bush versus Gore, he wrote the Saturday opinion of the Supreme Court, granting an unprecedented injunction to stop counting votes in Florida. 3 days later, by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court gave the election to George W. Bush, partly on the ground that the outstanding disputed balance couldn't be counted by midnight of that day as Florida law required. Of course not. The Supreme Court had stopped the counting of legal votes 3 days before. It was an act of judicial activism that might have made even Bob Bork blush. After the trade mission, Hillary and I joined John Sununu and Governor Ed DePreet of Rhode Island for a meeting with our Italian counterparts in Florence. It was the first trip to Italy for Hillary and me, and we fell in love with Florence, Siena, Pisa, San Gimignano, and Venice. I was also fascinated by the economic success of northern Italy, which had a higher per capita income than Germany. One of the reasons for the region's prosperity seemed to be the extraordinary cooperation of small business people in sharing facilities and administrative and marketing costs, as northern Italian artisans had been doing for centuries, since the development of medieval guilds. Once more, I had found an idea I thought might work in Arkansas. When I got home, we helped a group of unemployed sheet metal workers set up businesses and cooperate in cost-sharing and marketing, as I had observed Italian leather workers and furniture makers doing. In October, America's economy took a big jolt when the stock market fell by more than 500 points in one day, the biggest one-day drop since 1929. By coincidence, the richest man in America, Sam Walton, was sitting in my office when the market closed. Sam was the leader of the Arkansas Business Council, a group of prominent business people euphemistically known as the Good Suit Club. They were committed to improving education and the economy in Arkansas. Sam excused himself to see what had happened to Walmart stock. All his wealth was tied up in the company. He had lived in the same house for decades and drove an old pickup truck. When Sam came back, I asked him how much he'd lost. "About $1 billion," he said. In 1987, that was still a lot of money, even to Sam Walton. When I asked him if he was worried, he said, "Tomorrow I'm going to fly to Tennessee to see the newest Walmart. If there are plenty of cars in the parking lot, I won't be worried. I'm only in the stock market to raise money to open more stores and to give our employees a stake in the company." Almost all the people who worked for Walmart owned some of its stock. Walton was a stark contrast to the new breed of corporate executives who insisted on big pay increases even when their companies and workers weren't doing well, and on golden parachutes when their companies failed. When the collapse of many stocks in the first years of the new century exposed a new wave of corporate greed and corruption, I thought back to that day in 1987 when Sam Walton lost $1 billion of his wealth. Sam was a Republican. I doubt he ever voted for me. I didn't agree with everything Walmart did back then, and I don't agree with some of the company's practices that have become more common since he died. As I said, Walmart doesn't buy American as much as it used to. It's been accused of using large numbers of illegal immigrants, and of course the company is anti-union. But America would be better off if all our companies were run by people dedicated enough to see their own fortunes rise and fall with those of their employees and stockholders. I ended 1987 with my third speech of the decade at the Florida Democratic Convention, saying, as I always did, that we had to face the facts and get the American people to see them as we did. President Reagan had promised to cut taxes, raise defense spending, and balance the budget. He did the first two, but couldn't do the third because supply-side economics defies arithmetic. As a result, we had exploded the national debt, failed to invest in our future, and allowed wages to decline for 40% of our people. I knew the Republicans were proud of their record, but I looked at it with the perspective of the two old dogs watching young kids breakdancing. One old dog says to the other, "You know, if we did that, they'd worm us." I told the Florida Democrats, "We have to do nothing less than create a new world economic order and secure the place of the American people within it." The central arguments I made were, "We've got to pay the price today to secure tomorrow," and "We're all in it together." In retrospect, my speeches in the late 80s seem interesting to me because of their similarity to what I would say in 1992 and what I tried to do as president. In 1988, I traveled to 13 states and the District of Columbia to speak on topics about evenly divided between politics and policy. The policy speeches mostly concerned education and the need for welfare reform legislation, which we were hoping would pass the Congress by the end of the year. But the most important political speech for my future was one called Democratic Capitalism, which I delivered to the Democratic Leadership Council in Williamsburg, Virginia, on February 29th. From then on, I got more active in the DLC because I thought it was the only group committed to developing the new ideas Democrats needed both to win elections and do right by the country. In Williamsburg, I spoke about the need to make access to the global economy democratic, that is, available to all citizens and communities. I had become a convert to William Julius Wilson's argument, articulated in his book, The Truly Disadvantaged, that there were no race-specific solutions to hardcore unemployment and poverty. The only answers were schools, adult education and training, and jobs. Meanwhile, at home, I continued to wrestle with budget problems facing schools and prisons to promote my agenda for good beginnings, good schools, and good jobs, and to push for tax reform and lobbying reform legislation. Eventually, because the legislature wouldn't pass them, both these items were put on the ballot for the next election. The interest groups advertised heavily against them. Lobbying reform passed, and tax reform failed. Governor Dukakis was moving to secure the Democratic nomination for president. A couple of weeks before our convention opened in Atlanta, Mike asked me to nominate him. He and his campaign leaders told me that though he was leading in the polls against Vice President Bush, the American people didn't know him very well. They had concluded that the nominating speech was an opportunity to introduce him as a leader whose personal qualities, record in office, and new ideas made him the right person for the presidency. Because I was his colleague, his friend, and a Southerner, they wanted me to do it and to take the entire allotted time, about 25 minutes. This was a departure from the usual practice, which was to have three people representing different groups in our party give 5-minute nominating speeches. No one paid much attention to them, but they made the speakers and their constituents happy. I was flattered by the invitation, but wary. As I've said, conventions are loud meet-and-greet affairs where the words coming from the platform are usually just background music, except for the keynote address and the presidential and vice presidential acceptance speeches. I had been to enough conventions to know that another long speech would bomb unless the delegates and media were prepared for it and the conditions in the hall remained conducive to it. I explained to the Dukakis people that the speech would work only if the lights were down and the Dukakis floor operation worked to keep the delegates quiet. Also, they couldn't clap too much or it would substantially increase the length of the speech. I told them I knew that was going to be a lot of trouble, and if they didn't want to do it, I'd give him a rousing 5-minute endorsement instead. On the day of the speech, July 20th, I brought a copy of my remarks to Mike Sweet and showed it to him and his people. I told them that, as written, it would take about 22 minutes to deliver, and if there wasn't too much applause, we could stay within the 25-minute window. I described how I could cut 25% of the speech, or 50%, or 75%, if they thought that would be better. A couple of hours later, I called back to see what they wanted me to do. I was told to give it all. Mike wanted America to know him as I did. That night, I was introduced and walked out to strong music. As I began to speak, the lights were dimmed. It was all downhill after that. I wasn't through 3 sentences before the lights came up again. Then every time I mentioned Mike's name, the crowd roared. I knew right then I should scrap the speech in favor of the 5-minute option, but I didn't. The real audience was watching on television. If I could ignore the distractions in the hall, I could still tell the folks at home what Mike wanted them to hear. I want to talk about Mike Dukakis. He's come so far so fast that everybody wants to know what kind of person he is, what kind of governor he's been, and what kind of president he'll be. He's been my friend for a long time. I want you to know my answer to those questions and why I believe we should make Mike Dukakis the first American president born of immigrant parents since Andrew Jackson. As I proceeded to answer the questions, the convention got back to talking, except to cheer when Mike's name was mentioned. I felt as if the speech was a 200-pound rock I was pushing up a hill. I later joked that I knew I was in trouble when at the 10-minute mark, the American Samoan delegation started roasting a pig. A few minutes later, the ABC and NBC network started roasting me, showing the distracted convention hall and asking when I was going to finish. Only CBS and the radio networks ran the entire speech without critical commentary. The convention press people obviously hadn't been told how long I was expected to speak or what I was trying to do. Also, the way I wrote the speech was all wrong. In an attempt to tell Mike's story without too much interruption by applause, I made it both too conversational and too teachy. It was a big mistake to think I could speak only to people watching on TV without regard to how I would go over with the delegates. I had some good lines, but alas, the biggest applause I got was near the painful end when I said, "In closing." It was 32 minutes of total disaster. I kidded Hillary afterward that I wasn't sure just how badly I'd bombed until we were walking out of the arena and she started going up to total strangers and introducing me as her first husband. Fortunately, Mike Dukakis wasn't hurt by my misadventure. He got good reviews for naming Lloyd Benson as his running mate. They both gave good speeches, and the ticket left Atlanta with a hefty lead in the polls. On the other hand, I was a dead man walking. On July 21st, Tom Shales wrote a devastating piece in the Washington Post that summed up the press reaction to my speech. As Jesse Jackson had electrified the hall on Tuesday, Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas calcified it Wednesday night. He called it Windy Clinty's classic clinker and described in agonizing detail what the networks did to fill time until I finished. When we woke up the next morning, Hillary and I knew I had jumped into another pit I'd have to dig myself out of. I had no idea how to begin except to laugh at myself. My first public response was, "It wasn't my finest hour. It wasn't even my finest hour and a half." I kept my game face on, but I promised myself I would never again abandon my own instincts about a speech. And except for a brief moment in my speech to Congress on health care in 1994, I didn't. I was never so glad to get back home in my life. Arkansans were mostly supportive. My paranoid supporters thought I'd been set up by somebody. Most people just thought I'd sacrificed my normal spark and spontaneity to the shackles of a written speech. Robert Say McIntosh, a volatile black restaurateur with whom I had an on-again, off-again relationship, rose to my defense, slamming the media coverage and hosting a free lunch at the state capitol for anyone who turned in a postcard or letter hitting back at one of my national media critics. More than 500 people showed up. I got about 700 letters on the speech, 90% of them positive. Apparently, the people who wrote them had all heard the speech on radio or watched it on CBS, where Dan Rather at least waited until it was over to get his digs in. A day or so after I returned, I got a call from my friend Harry Thomason, producer of the successful TV show Designing Women, which his wife Linda Bloodworth wrote.
End of Disc 15. Disc 16.
A day or so after I returned, I got a call from my friend Harry Thomason, producer of the successful TV show Designing Women, which his wife Linda Bloodworth wrote. Harry was the brother of Danny Thomason, who sang next to me in the church choir. Hillary and I had gotten to know him and Linda in my first term when he came back to Arkansas to film a Civil War television movie, The Blue and the Gray. Harry told me I could make silk out of this sow's ear, but I had to move fast. He suggested I go on the Johnny Carson show and poke fun at myself. I was still shell-shocked and told him I needed a day to think about it. Carson had been having a field day with the speech in his monologues. One of his more memorable lines was, "The speech went over about as well as a Velcro condom." But there really wasn't much to consider. I couldn't end up any worse off than I already was. The next day, I called Harry and asked him to try to set up the Carson appearance. Carson normally didn't invite politicians on the show, but apparently he made an exception because I was too good a punching bag to pass up, and because I agreed to play the sax, which he could use as an excuse to keep his ban at least on non-musical politicians. The sax argument was Harry's idea, not the last clever one he would think up for me. A couple of days later, I was on a plane to California with Bruce Lindsay and my press secretary, Mike Galden. Before the show, Johnny Carson came by the room where I was waiting and said hello, something he almost never did. I guess he knew I had to be hurting and wanted to put me at ease. I was slated to come on stage shortly after the show started, and Carson began by telling the audience not to worry about my appearance because we'd got plenty of coffee and extra cots in the lobby. Then he introduced me, and introduced me, and introduced me. He dragged it out forever by telling everything his researchers could find out about Arkansas. I thought he was going to take longer than I did in Atlanta. When I finally came out and sat down, Carson took out a huge hourglass and put it down next to me so the whole world could see the sand running down. This performance would be time-limited. It was hilarious. It was even funnier to me because I'd brought my own hourglass, which the studio people said I absolutely could not take out. Carson asked me what had happened in Atlanta. I told him I wanted to make Mike Dukakis, who wasn't known for his oratorical skills, look good, and I succeeded beyond my wildest imagination. I told him Dukakis liked the speech so much, he wanted me to go to the Republican convention to nominate Vice President Bush, too. Then I claimed I'd blown the speech on purpose because I always wanted to be on this show in the worst way, and now I am. Johnny then asked if I thought I had a political future. I deadpanned an answer, "It depends on how I do on this show tonight." After we traded one-liners for a few minutes and got good laughs from the studio audience, Johnny invited me to play the sax with Doc Severinsen's band. We did an upbeat version of Summertime, which went over at least as well as the jokes. Then I settled in to enjoy the next guest, the famous English rocker Joe Cocker, as he sang his latest hit, "Unchain My Heart." After it was over, I was relieved and thought it had gone about as well as possible. Harry and Linda threw a party for me with some of their friends, including two other Arkansans, Oscar-winning actress Mary Steenburgen and Gil Gerard, whose first claim to fame was his starring role in Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. I took a red-eye flight home. The next day I learned that the Carson Show had earned good ratings nationwide and astronomical ones in Arkansas. Normally not enough Arkansans stayed up late enough to earn those ratings, but the honor of the state was at stake. When I walked into the state capitol, a hometown crowd was there to clap, cheer, and hug me for my performance. At least in Arkansas, the Carson Show had put the Atlanta debacle behind me. Things seemed to be looking up for me and the rest of America, too. CNN named me the political winner of the week after dubbing me its big loser just the week before. Tom Shales said that I had recovered miraculously and that people who watch television love this kind of comeback story. But it wasn't quite over. In August, Hillary, Chelsea, and I went to Long Island, New York, to spend a few days on the beach with our friend Liz Robbins. I was asked to umpire the annual charity softball game between artists and writers who spend summers there. I still have a picture of myself calling balls and strikes on the pitching of Mort Zuckerman, now publisher of the New York Daily News and U.S. News and World Report. When I was introduced on the field, the announcer joked that he hoped I didn't take as long to make the calls as I did to finish the speech in Atlanta. I laughed, but I was groaning inside. I didn't know what the crowd thought until the inning was over. A tall man stood up in the stands, walked out on the field, and came up to me. He said, "Don't pay any attention to the criticism. I actually listened to the speech and liked it a lot." It was Chevy Chase. I had always liked his movies. Now he had a fan for life. Neither my bad speech nor the Good Carson show had much to do with the real work I did as governor, but the ordeal had taught me all over again that how people perceive politicians has a big impact on what they can accomplish. It had also given me a healthy dose of humility. I knew that for the rest of my life, I would be more sensitive to people who found themselves in embarrassing or humiliating situations. I had to admit to Pam Strickland, an Arkansas Democrat reporter I really respected, "I'm not so sure it's bad for politicians to get knocked on their rear every now and then." Unfortunately, while things were looking up for me, they weren't going so well for Mike Dukakis. George Bush had given a marvelous acceptance speech at his convention, offering a kinder, gentler Reaganism and telling us to read my lips, no new taxes. Moreover, the vice president's kinder, gentler approach didn't extend to Mike Dukakis. Lee Atwater and company went after him like a pack of rabid dogs, saying Mike didn't believe in pledging allegiance to the flag or being tough on criminals. An independent group with no overt ties to the Bush campaign ran an ad featuring a convicted killer named Willie Horton, who had been released on a Massachusetts prison furlough program. Not coincidentally, Horton was black. His opponents were performing reverse plastic surgery on Dukakis, who didn't help himself by not responding quickly and vigorously to the attacks and by allowing himself to be photographed in a tank wearing a helmet that made him look more like Mad Magazine's Alfred E. Newman than a potential commander-in-chief of the armed forces. In the fall, I flew up to Boston to see what I could do to help. By then, Dukakis had fallen well behind in the polls. I pleaded with the people in the campaign to hit back, to at least tell the voters that the federal government, of which Bush was a part, furloughed prisoners too. But they never did it enough to suit me. I met Susan Estrich, the campaign manager, whom I liked and who I thought was shouldering too much of the blame for Mike's problems, and Madeleine Albright, a professor at Georgetown who had worked in the Carter White House. She was the foreign policy advisor. I was very impressed with her intellectual clarity and toughness and resolved to keep in touch with her. Dukakis found his voice in the last 3 weeks of the campaign, but he never recovered the New Democrat image that the negative ads and his insufficiently aggressive debate performances had destroyed. In November, Vice President Bush defeated him 54-46%. He didn't carry Arkansas either, though I tried. Dukakis was a good man and a fine governor. He and Lloyd Benson would have served our country well in the White House, but the Republicans had defined him right out of the race. I couldn't blame them for sticking with a strategy that worked, but I didn't think it was good for America. In October, while the campaign for president was in the home stretch, I was involved in two exciting policy developments. I began a new initiative with the governors of our neighbor states, Ray Mabus of Mississippi and Buddy Romer of Louisiana, to revive our economies. Both were young, articulate, Harvard-educated progressives. To highlight our commitment, we signed a compact on a barge in the middle of the Mississippi River at Rosedale. Not long afterward, we took a trade mission to Japan together, and we supported the successful effort of Senator Bumpers and Congressman Mike Espy of Mississippi to establish a Lower Mississippi Delta Development Commission to study and make recommendations to improve the economies of poor counties on both sides of the river, from southern Illinois to New Orleans, where the Mississippi flows into the Gulf of Mexico. The all-white counties in the northern part of the Delta region were in about as bad shape as the heavily black counties in the south. All three governors served on the Delta Commission. For a year, we had hearings up and down the river. In small towns, time had passed by, and we came up with a report that led to the establishment of a full-time office and an ongoing effort to improve the economy and quality of life in the poorest part of America outside the Native American tribal lands. On October 13th, I was invited to the White House for President Reagan's signing of the long-awaited welfare reform bill. It was a true bipartisan accomplishment, the work of Democratic and Republican governors. Democratic Congressman Harold Ford of Tennessee and Republican Congressman Carol Campbell of South Carolina, House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dan Rostenkowski, and Senate Finance Committee Chairman Pat Moynihan, who knew more about the history of welfare than anyone else, and the White House staff. I was impressed by and appreciative of the way the Congress and the White House had worked with the governors. Harold Ford even invited Republican Governor Mike Castle of Delaware and me to participate in his subcommittee's meeting to mark up the bill into the final version to be presented for a vote. I hoped and believed the legislation would help move more people from welfare to work while providing more support to their children. I was also glad to see President Reagan go out of office on a positive note. He had been badly battered by the illegal Iran-Contra affair, which the White House had approved, and which might have led to his impeachment had the Democrats been half as ruthless as Newt Gingrich. Despite my many disagreements with Reagan, I liked him personally, and I enjoyed listening to his stories when I sat at his table at the White House dinner for the governors, and when a few of the governors had lunch with him after his last address to us in 1988. Reagan was something of a mystery to me, at once friendly and distant. I was never sure how much he knew about the human consequences of his harshest policies, or whether he was using the hardcore right or being used by them. The books about him don't give a definitive answer, and because he developed Alzheimer's disease, we'll probably never know. Regardless, his own life is both more interesting and more mysterious than the movies he made. I spent the last 3 months of 1988 getting ready for the next legislative session. In late October, I released a 70-page booklet, Moving Arkansas Forward into the 21st Century, outlining the program I would present to the legislature in January. It reflected the work and recommendations of more than 350 citizens and public officials who had served on boards and commissions dealing with our most critical challenges. The booklet was filled with specific, innovative ideas, including school health clinics to fight teen pregnancy, health coverage through schools for uninsured children, parents' and students' right to choose to attend a public school other than the one in their geographical area, expansion of the HIPPE preschool program to all 75 counties, a report card on every school every year comparing students' performance with the previous year and with other schools in the state, a provision for state takeover of failing school districts, and a big expansion of the adult literacy program designed to make Arkansas the first state to obliterate adult illiteracy among working-age citizens. I was particularly excited about the literacy initiative and the prospect of turning illiteracy from a stigma into a challenge. The previous fall, when Hillary and I went to a PTA meeting at Chelsea School, a man had come up to me and said he had seen me on television talking about literacy. He told me he had a good job, but he had never learned to read. Then he asked me if I could get him into a literacy program without his employer knowing about it. I happened to know the employer and was sure he'd be proud of the man, but he was afraid. So my office got him into a reading program without his employer's knowledge. After that incident, I began to say that illiteracy was nothing to be ashamed of, but doing nothing about it would be. For all its sweep and new specifics, the program's central theme was the same one I had been hammering away on for the last 6 years. Either we invest more in human capital and develop our people's capacity to cooperate, or we are headed for long-term decline. Our old strategy of selling Arkansas as a beautiful state with hard-working people, low wages, and low taxes had lost its relevance a decade earlier due to the new realities of the global economy. We had to keep working to change it. After stumping the state for the rest of the year, I presented the program to the legislature on January 9, 1989. During the speech, I introduced Arkansans who supported it and the increased taxes necessary to pay for it. A school board president who had never voted for me but had been converted to the cause of education reform. A welfare mother who had enrolled in our work program and finished high school, started college, and gotten a job. A World War II veteran who had just learned to read, and the manager of the new $500 million Nakusa paper mill in Ashton, who told the legislators he had to have a better educated workforce because our productivity plan requires our workers to know statistics, and a lot of them don't understand that. I argued that we could afford to raise taxes. Our unemployment rate was still above the national average, down to 6.8% from 10.6% 6 years earlier. We ranked 46th in per capita income, but were still 43rd in per capita state and local taxes. At the end of my address, I noted that a few days earlier, Representative John Paul Capps, a friend and strong supporter of my program, was quoted in the press as saying that the people were getting sick and tired of Bill Clinton giving the same old speech. I told the legislature that I was sure many people were tired of hearing me say the same things, but that the essence of political responsibility is being able to concentrate on what is really important for a long period of time until the problem is solved. I said I would talk about something else when the unemployment rate is below the national average and income above the national average in our state. When no company passes us by because they think we can't carry the load in the new world economy. When no young person in this state ever has to leave home to find a good job. Until then, we've got to do our duty. I got some inspiration for giving the same old speech when Tina Turner came to Little Rock for a concert. After working through her new repertoire, Tina closed the show with her first top 10 hit, Proud Mary. As soon as the band started playing it, the crowd went wild. Tina walked up to the mic, smiled, and said, "You know, I've been singing this song for 25 years, but it gets better every time I do it." I was hoping my old song was still effective, too, but there was evidence to support John Paul Capps's assertion that Arkansans, including the legislators, were growing tired of my constant urgings. The legislature passed most of my specific reform proposals, but wouldn't raise the taxes necessary to fund the more expensive initiatives in health care and education, including another large increase in teacher salaries and the expansion of early childhood education to 3- and 4-year-olds. An early January poll showed that a majority of voters supported greater spending on education, and that I was ahead of other prospective candidates for governor in 1990. But the poll also indicated that half the respondents wanted a new governor. Meanwhile, some of my own first-rate people were getting tired, too, and wanted to go on to other challenges, including the exuberant state chairman of the Democratic Party, Lib Carlisle, a businessman I talked into taking the position when it would only take, I told him, a half a day a week. He later joked that I must have been referring to the time he'd had left for his own business. Fortunately, talented new people were still willing to come serve. One of the best and most controversial appointments I made was Dr. Jocelyn Elders to be director of the Department of Health. I told Dr. Elders I wanted to do something about teen pregnancy, which was a huge problem in Arkansas. When she advocated the establishment of school-based health clinics that, if the local school boards approved, would provide sex education and promote both abstinence and safe sex, I supported her. There were already a couple of clinics in operation, and they seemed to be popular and successful in reducing out-of-wedlock births. Our efforts generated a firestorm of opposition from fundamentalists who favored a just-say-no policy. It was bad enough in their eyes that Dr. Elders was pro-choice. Now they claimed that our efforts to set up school-based clinics would lead to sexual encounters by hordes of young people who would never have even considered doing such a thing if Jocelyn hadn't promoted the clinics. I doubted that Dr. Elders and her ideas even occurred to overheated teenagers in the back seats of their cars. It was a fight worth making. When I became president, I appointed Jocelyn Elders Surgeon General, and she was very popular with the public health community for her continued willingness to stick her neck out for sound, if controversial, health policies. In December 1994, after we had suffered staggering losses in the midterm congressional elections to the Republican right, Dr. Elders made headlines again for suggesting that teaching children to masturbate might be a good way to reduce the likelihood of teen pregnancy. At the time, I had all I could handle to maintain the support of skittish congressional Democrats, and I was determined to fight the Republicans on their radical proposals to cut education, health care, and environmental protection. Now I faced the prospect that Gingrich and Company could divert the attention of the press and the public away from their budget cuts by pillorying us. At any other time, we probably could have faced the heat. But I had already loaded the Democrats down with my controversial budget, NAFTA, the failed health care effort, and the Brady Bill and the assault weapons ban, which the National Rifle Association had used to beat about a dozen of our House members. I decided I had to ask for her resignation. I hated to, because she was honest, able, and brave. But we had already shown enough political tone deafness to last through several presidential terms. I hope someday she'll forgive me. She did a lot of good with the two appointments I gave her. The biggest staff loss I sustained in 1989 was Betsy Wright. In early August, she announced that she was taking a leave of absence for several weeks. I asked Jim Pledger to do double duty at Finance and Administration and as her temporary replacement. Betsy's announcement caused a lot of gossip and speculation because everyone knew she ran a tight ship in the governor's office and kept a close eye on everything that was going on in state government. John Brummett, the acerbic columnist for the Arkansas Gazette, wrote a column wondering whether our trial separation might end in divorce. He thought not, because we were too important to each other. That we were, but Betsy needed to get away. She had been working herself to death since my defeat in 1980, and it was taking its toll. We were both workaholics who got more irritable when we were exhausted. In 1989, we were trying to do a lot in a difficult climate, and we too often took our frustrations out on each other. At the end of the year, Betsy formally resigned as chief of staff after a decade of selfless service. In early 1990, I named Henry Oliver, a retired FBI agent and former chief of police in Fort Smith, as Betsy's successor. Henry didn't really want to do it, but he was my friend and believed in what we were trying to do, so he gave me a good year. Betsy came back in the 92 campaign to help defend me against attacks on my record and my personal life. Then, after a stint in Washington with Ann Wexler's lobbying firm early in my presidency, she went home to Arkansas to live in the Ozarks. Most Arkansans will never know the large role she played in giving them better schools, more jobs, and an honest, effective state government, but they should. I couldn't have accomplished much of what I did as governor without her. And without her, I never would have survived the Arkansas political wars to become president. At the beginning of August, President Bush announced that he was inviting the nation's governors to an education summit the following month. We met September 27th and 28th at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Many of the Democrats were skeptical of the meeting because the president and his Secretary of Education, Lauro Cavazos, made it clear the meeting was not a prelude to a large increase in federal support for education. I shared their concern, but I was excited by the prospect that the summit could produce a roadmap for the next steps in education reform, just as the Nation at Risk report had done in 1983. I believed the president's interest in education reform was genuine and agreed with him that there were important things we could do without new federal money. For example, the administration supported giving parents and students the right to choose a public school other than the one to which they were assigned. Arkansas had just become the second state after Minnesota to adopt the proposal, and I wanted the other 48 states to follow suit. I also believed that if the summit produced the right kind of report, governors could use it to build public support for more investment in education. If people knew what they would get for their money, their aversion to new taxes might lessen. As the co-chairman of the Governor's Task Force on Education, along with Governor Carol Campbell of South Carolina, I wanted to build a consensus among the Democrats, then to work with the Republicans on a statement reflecting the outcome of the summit. President Bush opened the meeting with a brief but eloquent speech. Afterward, we all took a stroll around the central lawn to give the photographers something for the evening news and morning papers, then went to work. The president and Mrs. Bush hosted a dinner that night. Hillary sat at the president's table and got into a debate with him about how bad America's infant mortality rate was. The president couldn't believe it when she said 18 countries did a better job than we did in keeping babies alive until the age of two. When she offered to get him the evidence, he said he would find it himself. He did, and the next day he gave me a note for Hillary saying she was right. It was a gracious gesture that reminded me of the day in Kennebunkport 6 years earlier when he had personally escorted 3-year-old Chelsea to the bathroom. When Carol Campbell was called home to deal with an emergency, I was left to work out the details of a summit statement with the NGA chairman, Republican Governor Terry Branstad of Iowa, the association's education staffer, Mike Cohen, and my aide, Representative Gloria Cabe. Laboring until well after midnight, several of us hammered out a statement committing the governors and the White House to development of a set of specific education goals to be achieved by the year 2000. Unlike the standards movement of the last decade, these goals would be focused on outputs, not inputs, obligating all of us to achieve certain results. I argued that we would look foolish unless we came out of Charlottesville with a bold commitment that would put new energy into education reform. From the start, most of the governors were behind the cause and supported the idea of making the summit the start of something big. Some of the president's people weren't so sure. They were afraid of committing him to a big idea that could get him into trouble by raising expectations of new federal funding. Because of the deficit and the president's no new taxes pledge, that wasn't in the cards. In the end, the White House came around, thanks to John Sununu, who was then the White House chief of staff. Sununu convinced his White House colleagues that the governors couldn't go home empty-handed, and I promised to minimize public pressure from the governors for more federal money. The final summit declaration said, "The time has come, for the first time in U.S. history, to establish clear national performance goals, goals that will make us internationally competitive." At the end of the summit, President Bush hand-wrote me a very cordial note thanking me for working with his staff on the summit and saying he wanted to keep education reform out there above the fray as we headed into the 1990 midterm election. I wanted that too. The Governor's Education Committee immediately began a process to develop the goals, working with the White House domestic policy advisor, Roger Porter, who had gone to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar a year after I did. We worked furiously over the next 4 months to reach agreement with the White House in time for the President's State of the Union address. By the end of January 1990, we had agreed on 6 goals for the year 2000. By the year 2000, All children in America will start school ready to learn. By the year 2000, the high school graduation rate will increase to at least 90%. By the year 2000, American students will leave grades 4, 8, and 12 having demonstrated competency in challenging subject matter, including English, mathematics, science, history, and geography. And every school in America will ensure that all students learn to use their minds well so they may be prepared for responsible citizenship, further learning, and productive employment in our modern economy. By the year 2000, U.S. students will be first in the world in science and mathematics achievement. By the year 2000, every adult in America will be literate and will possess the knowledge and skills necessary to compete in a global economy and exercise the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. By the year 2000, every school in America will be free of drugs and violence and will offer a disciplined environment conducive to learning. On January 31st, I sat in the gallery of the House of Representatives as President Bush announced these goals, said they were developed jointly by the White House and the Governor's Task Force on Education, and reported that they would be part of a more comprehensive goals and objectives statement that we would present to all the governors at their winter meeting the next month. The document the governors adopted in late February was a worthy successor to the 1983 Nation at Risk report. I was proud to have been a part of it, impressed by the knowledge and commitment of my fellow governors, and grateful to the President, John Sununu, and Roger Porter. For the next 11 years as governor and president, I worked hard to reach the national education goals. We had set the bar high. When you set a high bar and reach for it, even if you fall short, you wind up well ahead of where you started. I spent the last months of 1989 trying to decide what to do with the rest of my life. There were good arguments against running for a fifth term. I was discouraged by my inability to raise the funds necessary to keep moving forward in education, early childhood development, and health care. I could stop after 10 years, look back on a decade of real accomplishments under difficult circumstances, and leave open the option of running for president in 1992. Finally, if I ran again, I might not win. I had already served longer than anyone but Orville Faubus, and the polls indicated that a lot of people wanted a new governor. On the other hand, I loved both politics and policy, and I didn't want to leave office with the bad taste of 1989's money failures in my mouth. I still had an able, energetic, and extremely honest team. The whole time I was governor, only twice had I been offered money to make a decision a particular way. A company that wanted to win the bid to provide medical services in the prison system offered me a substantial amount through a third party. I had the company taken off the bid list. A county judge asked me to see an elderly man who wanted a pardon for his nephew. The old fellow had had no contact with state government in decades, and obviously thought he was doing what he had to when he offered me $10,000 for the pardon. I told the man it was lucky for him I was hard of hearing, because he might have just committed a crime. I suggested that he go home and give the money to his church or a charity, and said I'd look into his nephew's case. On most days, I still looked forward to going to work, and I had no idea what I'd do if I gave it up. At the end of October, I went out to the state fair as I did every year. That year, I sat at a booth for several hours and talked to anyone who wanted to see me. Along toward the end of the day, a man in overalls who looked to be about 65 dropped by to visit. It was an enlightening experience.
"Bill, are you going to run again?" he asked.
"I don't know," I replied. "If I do, will you vote for me?"
"I guess so. I always have," he answered.
"Aren't you sick of me after all these years?" I inquired. He smiled and said, No, I'm not, but everybody else I know is. I chuckled and answered, Don't they think I've done a good job? He shot back, Sure they do, but you got a paycheck every 2 weeks, didn't you? It was a classic example of another of Clinton's law of politics. All elections are about the future. I was supposed to do a good job, just like everyone else who worked for a living. A good record is helpful mostly as evidence that you'll do what you say if reelected. In November, the Berlin Wall, symbol of the Cold War divide, fell. Like all Americans, I cheered at the sight of young Germans tearing it down and taking chunks of it for souvenirs. Our long standoff against communist expansion in Europe was ending with the victory of freedom, thanks to the united front presented by NATO and the constancy of American leaders from Harry Truman to George Bush. I thought back to my own trip to Moscow almost 20 years earlier, the eagerness of young Russians for information and music from the West, and the hunger for freedom that it represented. Not long afterward, I received two pieces of the Berlin Wall from my longtime friend David Ifshin, who had been in Berlin on that fateful night of November 9th and joined in with the Germans in chipping away at the wall. David had been an intense and visible opponent of the Vietnam War. His joy at the fall of the wall symbolized the promise that all Americans saw in the post-Cold War era. In December, my old pastor and mentor, W.O. Vaught, lost his battle with cancer. He had retired from Emmanuel a few years earlier and was replaced by Dr. Brian Harbor, a fine young pastor who represented the dwindling ranks of progressive Southern Baptists with whom I identified. Dr. Vaught had remained active in retirement until his illness made him too weak to travel and speak. A couple of years earlier, he had come to visit me in the governor's mansion. He said he wanted to tell me three things. First, he said he knew I was concerned about the morality of capital punishment, though I had always supported it. He told me that the biblical commandment, Thou shalt not kill, did not forbid lawful executions, because the root Greek word did not cover all killing. He said the literal meaning of the commandment was, Thou shalt not commit murder. Second, he said he was concerned about fundamentalist attacks on me for my pro-choice position on abortion. He wanted me to know that while he believed abortion was usually wrong, the Bible did not condemn it, nor did it say life begins at conception, but when life has been breathed into a baby, when it is slapped on the behind after being taken out of the mother's body. I asked him about the biblical statement that God knows us even when we are in our mother's womb. He replied the verse simply refers to God being omniscient, and that it might as well have said God knew us even before we were in our mother's womb, even before anyone in our direct line was born. The final thing Dr. Vaught said took me aback. He said, Bill, I think you're going to be president someday. I think you'll do a good job, but there's one thing above all you must remember. God will never forgive you if you don't stand by Israel. He believed God intended the Jews to be at home in the Holy Land. While he didn't disagree that the Palestinians had been mistreated, he said the answer to their problem had to include peace and security for Israel. In mid-December, I went to see Dr. Vaught. He was wasting away, too weak to leave his bedroom. He asked me to move his Christmas tree into his bedroom so that he could enjoy it in his last days. Fittingly, Dr. Vaught died on Christmas Day. Jesus never had a more faithful follower, and I never had a more faithful pastor and counselor. Now I would have to navigate the path he had predicted, and the perils of my own soul without him. Chapter 25. While I was trying to decide whether to run again, the governor's race was shaping up to be a real Donnybrook, whether I ran or not. Years of pent-up ambitions were being unleashed. On the Democratic side, Jim Guy Tucker, Attorney General Steve Clark, and Rockefeller Foundation President Tom McRae, whose grandfather had been governor, all announced they would run. They were all friends of mine and had good ideas and progressive records. On the Republican side, the contest was even more interesting. It involved two formidable former Democrats, Congressman Tommy Robinson, who didn't like Washington, and Sheffield Nelson, former president of Arkansas-Louisiana Gas Company, who said he had switched parties because the Democratic Party had moved too far to the left. It was the standard explanation white Southerners gave, but more interesting coming from him because he had supported Senator Ted Kennedy against President Carter in 1980. Robinson and Nelson and their backers, all one-time friends, went after one another with a vengeance in a race full of name-calling and mudslinging, which included Robinson's charge that Nelson and Jerry Jones, a longtime friend of both men who owned some of the gas fields that supplied ARCLA, were rapacious businessmen who soaked ARCLA's ratepayers for personal gain, and Nelson's charge that Robinson was unstable and unfit to be governor. About all they agreed on was that I had raised taxes too much and had too little to show for it in terms of educational improvement and economic development. On the Democratic side, Steve Clark withdrew from the race, leaving Jim Guy Tucker and Tom McRae, who took a different approach, more clever than that of the Republicans, to discourage me from running. They said I'd done a lot of good, but I was out of new ideas and out of time. 10 years as governor was long enough. I couldn't get anything done in the legislature anymore, and 4 more years would give me too much control over all aspects of state government. McRae had met with focus groups of representative voters who said they wanted to continue the direction I'd set in economic development, but were open to new ideas from a new leader. I thought there was something to their argument, but I didn't believe they could get more out of our conservative anti-tax legislators than I could. Finally, still uncertain of what to do, I set a March 1st deadline to announce my decision. Hillary and I hashed it over dozens of times. There was some press speculation that she would run if I didn't. When asked about it, I said she'd be a great governor, but I didn't know if she would run. When I discussed it with her, Hillary said she'd cross that bridge if I decided not to run, but what she might do should be no part of my decision. She knew before I did that I wasn't ready to hang it up. In the end, I couldn't bear the thought of walking away from a decade of hard work with my last year marked by repeated failures to fund further improvements in education. I never was one for quitting, and whenever I was tempted, something always happened to give me heart. In the mid-80s, when our economy was in the tank, I was about to land a new industry for a county where 1 in 4 people was unemployed. At the last minute, Nebraska offered the company an extra $1 million, and I lost the deal. I was crushed and felt I had failed the whole county. When Linda Dixon, my secretary, saw me slumped in my chair with my head in my hands, she tore off the daily scripture reading from the devotional calendar she kept on her desk. The verse was Galatians 6:9. Let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. I went back to work. On February 11th, I witnessed the ultimate testimonial to the power of perseverance. Early that Sunday morning, Hillary and I got Chelsea up and took her down to the kitchen of the governor's mansion to see what we told her would be one of the most important events she'd ever witness. Then we turned on the television and watched Nelson Mandela take the last steps in his long walk to freedom. Through 27 years of imprisonment and abuse, Mandela had endured and triumphed to end apartheid, liberate his own mind and heart from hatred, and inspire the world. At the March 1st press conference, I said I would run for a fifth term, although the fire of an election no longer burns in me, because I wanted another chance to finish the job of improving education and modernizing the economy, and because I thought I could do a better job of it than the other candidates. I also promised to keep bringing new people into state government and to bend over backward to avoid abuse of power. Looking back on it, I can see how the statement looked ambivalent and a touch arrogant, but it was an honest expression of how I felt as I began the first campaign since 1982 that I could have lost. I got a break soon afterward when Jim Guy Tucker decided to withdraw from the race and run for lieutenant governor instead, saying a divisive primary would only increase the chances of a Republican victory in the fall, no matter who won. Jim Guy had made a judgment that he could win the lieutenant governor's race easily, then become governor in 4 years. He was almost certainly right, and I was relieved. Still, I couldn't take the primary for granted. McRae was waging a vigorous campaign and had a lot of friends and admirers around the state from his years of good work at the Rockefeller Foundation. When he made his formal announcement, he had a broom in his hand and said he wanted to make a clean sweep of state government, clearing out old ideas and career politicians. The broom tactic had worked for my neighbor David Boren when he ran for governor in Oklahoma in 1974. I was determined that it wouldn't work this time. Gloria Cabe agreed to manage the campaign, and she put together an effective organization. Maurice Smith raised the money, and I followed a simple strategy: to outwork my opponents, do my job, and continue to preach new ideas, including college scholarships for all high school students with a B average or better, and a Plant the Future initiative to plant 10 million more trees a year for a decade to do our part to reduce greenhouse gases and global warming. McRae was forced to become more critical of me, which I think made him somewhat uncomfortable, but which had some impact. All the candidates hit me for my involvement in national politics. In late March, I went to New Orleans to accept the chairmanship of the Democratic Leadership Council. I was convinced the group's ideas on welfare reform, criminal justice, education, and economic growth were crucial to the future of the Democratic Party and the nation. The DLC's positions were popular in Arkansas, but my high profile was a potential liability in the race, so I got back home as soon as I could. In April, the AFL-CIO refused for the first time to endorse me. Bill Becker, their president, had never really liked me. He thought the sales tax increase was unfair to working people, opposed the tax incentives I'd supported to lure new jobs to Arkansas, and blamed me for the failure of the tax reform referendum in 1988. He was also furious that I had supported a $300,000 loan guarantee to a business involved in a labor dispute. I spoke to the labor convention, defending the tax increase for education and expressing amazement that Becker would blame me for the failure of tax reform, which I had supported but the people voted against. I also stood by the loan guarantee because it saved 410 jobs. The company sold its products to Ford Motor Company, and the loan enabled it to build a 2-month inventory, without which Ford would have canceled the firm's contract and put it out of business. Within 2 weeks, 18 local unions defied Becker and endorsed me anyway. They didn't fall into the classic liberal trap of making the perfect the enemy of the good. If the people who voted for Ralph Nader in 2000 hadn't made the same mistake, Al Gore would have been elected president. The only dramatic moment of the primary came when I was out of state again. While I was in Washington presenting the report of the Delta Development Commission to Congress, McRae called a press conference at the state capitol to criticize my record. He thought he would have the Arkansas press all to himself. Hillary thought otherwise. When I called her the night before, she said she thought she might show up at the conference. McRae had a cardboard likeness of me by his side. He attacked me for being absent from the state, implied that I had refused to debate him, and began to criticize my record by posing questions for me and supplying the answers himself. In the middle of McRae's routine, Hillary stepped out of the crowd and interrupted him. She said Tom knew I was in Washington promoting the Delta Commission's recommendations, which would help Arkansas. She then produced a prepared summary of several years of Rockefeller Foundation reports praising my work as governor. She said that he had been right in the reports and that Arkansas should be proud. We've made more progress than any other state except South Carolina, and we're right up there with them. It was unheard of for a candidate's wife, much less the first lady, to confront an opponent like that. Some people criticized Hillary for it, but most people knew she had earned the right to defend the work we had done together for years, and it broke McRae's momentum. When I got home, I lit into him for his attacks and went after his economic development strategy, saying he wanted to build a wall around Arkansas. I won the election with 55% of the vote over McRae and several other challengers. But Tom had run a smart campaign on a shoestring budget and had done well enough to encourage the Republicans about their prospects in the fall. Sheffield Nelson beat Tommy Robinson in the Republican primary and promised to run against me on my tax and spend record. The strategy was flawed. Nelson should have run as a moderate Republican, praised my work in education and economic development, and said 10 years was long enough. I should be given a gold watch and a respectable retirement. By switching from his original position in support of the school standards and the sales tax increase to pay for them, Nelson allowed me to escape the straitjacket of tired incumbency and run as the only candidate of positive change. The fact that Nelson was running against the education program and taxes had the added benefit that, if I won, I could argue to the legislators that the people had voted for more progress. As we moved toward Election Day, the AFL-CIO finally endorsed me. The Arkansas Education Association recommended me because of my commitment to raising teacher salaries, Nelson's promise not to raise taxes for 4 years, and AEA President Sid Johnson's desire to bury the hatchet and get on with business. Nelson, meanwhile, moved farther to the right, advocating a reduction in welfare benefits for illegitimate children and hitting me for vetoing a bill the National Rifle Association had pushed through the legislature. The bill would have prohibited local governments from enacting any restrictions on firearms or ammunition. It was a smart move by the NRA because state legislators were invariably more rural and pro-gun than city councils, but I thought the bill was bad policy. If the Little Rock City Council wanted to ban cop killer bullets in the face of increasing gang activity, I thought they should have the right to do so. The work of the governor's office didn't stop for the campaign. In June, I approved the first executions in Arkansas since 1964. John Swindler was convicted of murdering an Arkansas policeman and two South Carolina teenagers. Ronald Gene Simmons killed his wife, three sons, four daughters, a son-in-law, a daughter-in-law, four grandchildren, and two people he had grudges against. Simmons wanted to die. Swindler didn't. They were both executed in June. I didn't have qualms about either of them, but I knew there were tougher cases awaiting us. I had also begun to commute the sentences of a few murderers with life sentences, so that they could be eligible for parole. As I explained to the voters, I had not commuted a sentence for years after the bad experience during my first term, but both the prison board and the paroles and pardons board pleaded with me to resume commuting some lifers. Most states made lifers eligible for parole after serving several years. In Arkansas, the governor had to commute their sentences. The decisions weren't easy or popular, but were necessary to keep peace and order in a prison system where 10% of the inmates were serving life terms. It's fortunate that many lifers are unlikely to repeat their crimes and can return to society without risk to others. This time, we made extensive efforts to contact the victims' families for comments. Surprisingly, many did not object. Also, most of those whose sentences were commuted were old or had committed their crimes when they were very young. In mid-September, a disgruntled former employee of the Development Finance Authority first raised the sex question against me. Larry Nichols had made more than 120 phone calls from his office to conservative supporters of the Nicaraguan Contras, a cause the National Republicans strongly supported. Nichols' defense was that he was calling the Contra supporters to get them to lobby congressional Republicans to support legislation beneficial to his agency. His excuse didn't fly, and he was fired when the calls were discovered. Nichols called a press conference on the steps of the Capitol and accused me of using the finance agency's funds to carry on affairs with five women. I drove into my parking place in front of the Capitol not long after Nichols had made his charges and was hit cold with the story by Bill Simmons of the Associated Press, the senior member of the political press and a good reporter. When Simmons asked me about the charges, I just suggested he call the women. He did, they all denied it, and the story basically died. None of the television stations or newspapers ran it. Only one conservative radio announcer who supported Nelson talked about it, actually naming one of the women, Jennifer Flowers. She threatened to sue him if he didn't stop. The Nelson campaign tried to stoke the rumors, but without corroboration or evidence.